This week on the show, we have an interview with Jamie McParland of the Newburgh Public School District in Oregon. We're going to be getting to take an inside look at how they use BSD in various aspects of operations across their network, as well, of course, as bringing you the latest news and questions. So keep it tuned to BSD Now, the place to be, SD. BSD Now, episode 131, BSD Behind the Chalkboard, recorded March 2nd, 2016. Hey, I'm your host, Chris Moore.
And I'm Alan Jude.
And I'm glad to have you guys with us this week. We got another exciting episode. There's going to be a great interview you're going to want to stick around for. That should be fun. Mm-hmm. But, of course, we got a lot of news to get to, and this is kind of right on the eve of Asia BSD Con. So definitely looking forward to that. Alan, I don't know. I'm ready to go get some noodles.
How about you? Yes. I'm looking forward to that. Which day do you arrive?
I leave Monday, so I guess I arrive Tuesday in Japan.
Same here.
Tuesday afternoon.
Which airport are you landing in, though?
Narita.
Ah, I'm at Haneda.
How do you manage that? I always end up going through Narita. Like, that's not even
an option. Well, up until a couple of months ago, no U.S. airline was allowed to fly to Haneda.
Oh.
Air Canada only opened up 2 years ago. Okay. I actually would prefer to go to Narita because it's a little easier to get into the city.
Sure.
It takes about the same amount of time, really, but Narita's farther away, but it's a faster train.
Yeah, the train's real easy, too.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Get on it and just take a nap for half an hour.
Right, whereas...
By that point, I'm ready.
Yeah, whereas coming from Haneda, you get on, like, regular commuter trains, mm-hmm. and so you're not guaranteed a seat, and there's no luggage area.
Oh, man. Probably a lot of stops in between, right?
Yeah, and we had to switch trains, like, twice, I think.
Oh, no,
so it wasn't.
Okay,
it wasn't terrible.
Have that.
Yeah.
Usually at that point, I'm so tired and jet lagged.
Yes.
It's like all I can do just to take the one or two trains to get to my hotel.
Right. And, you know, I like Narita, but Air Canada only runs Narita during the summer now, not during the winter.
Sure.
They're like, oh, you can just go to Narita.
Like, so I saw we didn't get lucky with the hotel this year, too. Like the speakers, or at least Drew and John that I talked to are at a different hotel now.
Ah.
So they booked them. That's a couple blocks down from where we're going to be at. But still, yeah, it'll work out.
Where are you?
At the Villa Fontaine.
Okay, that's where I'm at.
Yep. Yeah, same place as you.
Oh, yes.
We booked around the same time.
Oh, yeah, like I booked in October.
Yeah.
I hope the reason the speakers aren't there is because a bunch of us regulars took all the
That's probably what happened, right? We were all thinking, ooh, that's where the speakers were last year. We're going to book ahead.
Well, they weren't
time.
There last year because they...
Oh.
It was so late last
right.
year.
I wonder if that's what happened again this year.
Probably.
Then. Yeah,
judging by everything was
like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Oh,
we'll
yes.
have a lot of stories to bring you when we get back. Hopefully a bunch of new interviews.
I have to
interviews.
Like, take notes during it to remember all the cool stories.
Yeah. You know, I should just invest, just go out and buy a little audio recorder like you have.
Yes.
So I can just sit and put that down and then transcribe it later or whatever. But it'll be fun. There's going to be a lot of good stuff. Definitely check it out online if there's any live feeds or streams.
Yes,
live con shows up.
The main Asia BSD con will definitely be streamed, and I'm pretty sure the Beehive Con will be, and maybe even the Dev Summit. I'm not sure about that.
Oh, okay.
But definitely Asia BSD Con will be screened by Stale Engine. And I think Beehive... yes, I will make sure Beehive Con happens, even though I will be in a different room for part of it. Because I'm taking George Neville Neal's D-Trace tutorial.
Oh, you'll pop in to get some food, though.
Yes, well, yeah. I did help pay for the food. So
you need to at least get a plate.
Yes.
And it'll probably be good, too.
Oh, yes. So. Well, it's nice thing is a bento box. I can take it with me if I have to.
There you go. There you go.
But yes, we're looking forward to that a lot.
Oh, yeah, very much so. Not the flight so much, although I was a little smarter this year. I didn't go through Atlanta, so the 14-hour flight is going to be only 11 hours. So I'm going to Minneapolis first. So,
so you take a small hop and then... Okay.
Yeah.
I luckily have a direct flight.
Well, I got to take a hop no matter where I go.
Right.
Knoxville doesn't fly direct to many places.
So. Well, yes, I can't fly from Hamilton. I'd have to fly Hamilton to Calgary and then get on a plane to Tokyo, which probably would actually be another small hop to Vancouver and then to Tokyo. But luckily.
But either way, looking forward to it. If you're going to be out there, come say hi to Alan and I. It'll be a lot of fun. We'll be happy to talk to you about all kinds of cool BSD stuff, and maybe we'll pull you aside and do an interview if you're working on something, because we've got to get a lot of those. So, of course, we should probably get into the headline. So, speaking of conferences, what is this? We have the BSD CAN list of talks has been announced. So
they haven't
we can now tease you with that.
Yeah. They haven't quite managed to actually build a schedule out of it yet, but they have the list of talks they've accepted, and they're just trying to figure out how to build a schedule out of it such that, you know, no matter what your interest is, there will always be stuff for you to go do, and try to avoid putting two talks that would be of interest to mostly the same people at the same time, which I can tell you is not an easy thing to do.
Sure.
But,
well, that's one of those things. To some degree, you're always going to lose that battle, right?
Yes.
There's just a lot of really good talks. Mm-hmm. Some of them are just going to have to go head-to-head.
Yes.
Hey, that's what video recordings are for.
Exactly. But, you know, BSDcon usually does a good job of having kind of like a sysadmin track and a developer track. Now, I now fall into both of those categories and have this problem. But in general, we look forward to seeing how they manage to juggle this list of amazing talks.
Do you want to run through them real quick and tease everyone?
There's quite a few. Kirk McCusick will be giving a brief history of the BSD fast file system. Mm-hmm. If you've never heard one of Kirk's history talks, you must absolutely see this. If you've only seen some of the other ones, like I saw, I think that MeetBSD did the history of TCP/IP. Well, you know, if you've seen one of the other ones, you definitely already are planning to go to this one. And even if you've already heard the history of the fast file system, the stories are so great, you will hear it again. You know, I'm sure that room will be very, very full.
Oh, yeah.
George Neville Neal will be giving his an inside look at FreeBSD with DTrace, which is a tutorial.
It's a full day one.
Yes. So at Asia, it's also a full day, but it's split across 2 days. So you do half the full day one day and half the full day the other day, which I imagine had to do with George having things to do.
Sure.
And the dev summit and the vendor summit and so on. But yes, so if you are busy and or didn't make it to Tokyo, you'll be able to get that in Canada. Werner Losch will be giving a walkthrough of CAM, which is the basically how disks work in FreeBSD. So that will be, I think I will have to go to that one and learn a bit more about it because I've been working in related places for a while and really would like to know what was going on there. So
definitely bone up on that. Hey, it looks like next we got Aaron Poffenberger, who we interviewed from down in Texas, going to be doing an amateur radio and SDR BOF as well.
Yes, if you wanted to learn about software-defined radios or whatever. The BOFs are usually during lunchtime, but without the schedule, we don't know for sure. But it's definitely worth, you know, if you're going to grab your lunch and go sit somewhere, you might as well join in a discussion about something you're interested in or learn something.
To be honest, you're going to be doing that anyway. You're going to be sitting with other developers talking. Just make it official.
Yep.
All right, so who's next? We got Rake Flotter is going to be doing an OpenFlow implementation for OpenBSD.
Yes, so OpenFlow is an open source version of Cisco's thing for analyzing the traffic as it goes through your router. So that obviously makes a lot of sense there. George Rosamond, who's I think that's the NYC bug guy, he's giving Beyond Model Cultures, which I'm guessing is related to his Tor diversity project.
That's and trying what to get, I would assume.
And maybe not just Tor, but, you know, model cultures are bad in everything, so fix that. Then Peter Hessler is giving a talk about the bidirectional forwarding detection, or BFD, implementation for OpenBSD. So this is more accurately detecting when you have two different routes, if one of them goes down and routing around it. So that seems really interesting if you're doing any kind of network engineering type stuff.
Who's this next guy?
I have no idea. Never heard of him.
Booting from encrypted disks on FreeBSD. Yes. So this will be the same talk you give me in Tokyo, I assume, right?
Yes, although hopefully by the time BSDcon rolls around, it also features a whole chunk of the talk about UEFI instead of only BIOS. So I'm hoping that it'll be quite a bit different by the time BSDcon rolls around.
By the way, were you going to commit that stuff before you do your talk in Tokyo, or at least get it?
I'm hoping the talk in Tokyo gets me a couple people to review it so I can commit it. Yes, and then Peter Hanstein, as usual, runs his PF tutorial. If you want to learn how to use PF, no matter which of the BSDs you're using it on, you should definitely check that out. It's a great thing to do on one of the days before the conference. Because as we'll mention, I guess, even if you're only coming for the regular talk part of BSDcon, you want to be there by Tuesday night for the Goat Boff, which is, you know, where Groff comes out to the local pub that's nearest the venue, and everybody just meets up and hangs out. And so since you're going to want to be there on Tuesday night for that, you might as well, you know, slot yourself in for the tutorials and learn something while you're there.
Okay. We got next Marius Zaborski.
Yes, Marius.
Capsicum and Casper.
Yes, so Capsicum is the sandboxing framework, and Casper is the daemon that handles stuff that you can't normally do in a sandbox. Sure. So it handles like DNS resolution and stuff, because if you're in the sandbox and we don't allow you to make connections out to the network, how are you going to look up DNS or things like that? And then Paul Shestov, or Shestek, a couple of years ago, he gave a talk about moving from Linux to FreeBSD.
Sure.
He's giving an updated version of that called Case Study, Linux to FreeBSD to FreeBSD, which I'm guessing is about...
VM?
Well, I imagine it's more after they transitioned to FreeBSD, now they need to move from, you know, FreeBSD 8 or whatever up to 10 or something.
Okay.
So...
it's going to be a nested BSD thing with Beehive and whatnot. But
I don't actually know. We'll have to... Once the schedule goes up, there'll be summaries of each of the talks, and we'll know a little bit more.
Okay.
Then... Massimiliano Stucci will be giving two tutorials, did the day before. He works for Ripe and gives lots of these types of tutorials. But if you want to learn about creating a nice IPv6 addressing plan, he's giving that. And then there's also a tutorial on DNSSEC.
Nice. Okay.
Yep,
and then Eichhorn's going to be doing dodging raindrops, escaping the public cloud.
There you go.
Maybe running your own cloud stuff there.
Probably.
Yeah, I need summaries.
Cool. Yep. Brooks Davis is everything you ever wanted to know about Hello World. So this would be different than, I'm guessing this is related to Cherry and what happens when you change Hello World to run on, you know, with 128-bit pointers with capabilities or something. You know, and the summaries would be handy to have, but... looking forward to that. Nick Wolf, who we interviewed recently, will be talking about his work to upgrade from FreeBSD 8 to 10 and the lessons he learned there. I'm sure there are lots of people in that same boat, and you know, they will learn lots. And
I'm kind of encouraged to see that a lot of the folks we've interviewed who haven't come to BSDCAN before, it looks like this will be their first time, and they're giving a talk. So that's really cool. See, doing an interview on the show just opens up doors for you. So definitely come on.
Yes. Like, you know, John Baldwin. Nobody's ever heard of him before, and he's never been to BSDCAN before.
Yeah.
He'll be presenting about FreeBSD and GDB.
Okay, yeah. So we have also FreeBSD-based high-density filers. Looks like Wojcik. Are we doing that?
No, that's Baptiste.
Oh, that's Baptiste, sorry.
The table is hard to read.
Eh? I know, it's hard. I'm having to highlight him as I go through to make sure.
It's Kirk Russell's fault. He's got this really long name for his talk, and it skewed the whole field. yes, but Wojcik will be talking about the Cavium ThunderX system on a chip, which is the ARM64. Then... Vinicius Zavim will be talking about Beakabone Black and robotics.
That'll be
cool if you're into that kind of thing.
Well attended one.
And then Aaron Poffenberger will be giving a second BOF. He made the mistake I did last year of recommending a whole list of BOFs and getting stuck being in charge of all of them.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Now you can do that.
Yep. So he's giving one about Haskell.
Okay.
And so if you're interested in that, definitely check that out. Mike Belofov will be talking about Zen PVHVM for OpenBSD.
That'll be a hot one.
Yep. Then Kajetan, I'm not going to butcher that last name. I think that might be the Solaris guy who's working on PF. I'm not sure. But it's talk about improving PF's performance and reliability. Hence why I thought it might be the guy from Solaris working on PF. Brian Drury will be talking about his recent work to improve the FreeBSD build system. He's been doing a lot of stuff.
Packaging there. Base and stuff?
No, this one is more building world faster and removing some of the old cruft. And like integration of C-cache and all that. Lots of stuff to make it faster. Warren Block will be talking about improving the FreeBSD translation tools. So if you're interested in getting the FreeBSD documentation in other languages, that's a great one. Giuseppe Letteria will be talking about JSON-based configuration of kernel subsystems.
Interesting. That would actually tie into RAPI really well.
Yeah, so especially since JSON is compatible with UCL.
Yes. I will have to go talk to him about that.
Indeed.
Maybe attend that talk.
Indeed.
Okay. So we got David Italiano is going to be doing LLD, the new linker for FreeBSD. Mm-hmm. That sounds interesting. That'll be a lecture.
Yeah. And then we have
how do you pronounce that? Peter Egg, I'm not sure how to pronounce the last
Puno
name.
Puno Savek?
Yeah. Limits in the practical usability of BSDs, a big data perspective.
Oh, that'll definitely be cool. Interesting. You know, that's the kind of thing we really like to see is more people telling us where the problems are in BSD so that we can fix them. And then Massa Milano will actually be giving a lecture as well called Making the Internet More Secure. You know, coming from the perspective of RIPE, that will definitely be very interesting.
Okay.
And then Sean Chittenden, who we've interviewed here, will be talking about modern tooling to assist with developing applications on FreeBSD.
Nice.
So, again, more feedback from industry, which we like to see. Dexuan Chu will be talking about networking performance improvements for FreeBSD guests in Hyper-V. So how to get more network I/O out of your VMs, which I'm guessing will apply to things other than just Hyper-V.
Oh, that's nice. Hey, Bernard Spill is going to be doing an open/Libre SSL on FreeBSD.
Indeed.
See that. See if he's got his new private Libre SSL on base yet or not.
Yep.
That'd be cool.
Antoine Charcuteau will be talking about the OpenBSD RC.D. Michael Lucas, OpenPAM and BSD.
Nice.
Aaron Poffenberger will be giving a tutorial on OpenSMTVD. So if you want to learn how to set that up, check it out.
What's that? Three things he's doing now? I think he mentioned this on the show. He was going to submit a bunch in the hopes that one of them got accepted. Now you're doing them all. Sorry.
Yeah, so he's got a tutorial before the conference, the boffs during every lunch during the conference, and I guess that's just it.
Half-day tutorial?
Well, yeah, he's got a half-day tutorial and then two boffs.
Mm-hmm. Like, nice. Okay.
This one I'm interested in. Matt Ahrens will be talking about OpenZFS space allocation. Okay. So how ZFS actually lays out the stuff on disk. I wonder if any of the stuff we talked about at the Storage Summit about how SMR will have to change some of this will apply. Mm-hmm. That'll be definitely interesting. Very glad to see Matt coming out to BSD Can again. Hopefully he has more luck than he did the other year where all the flights got screwy and he arrived with no luggage.
Well, that happens to everybody, or somebody at least every year.
Yes. So. Well, it happened to a lot of people. Well, you didn't even make it that year.
No, that one year I didn't even make it back home.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Sebastian Benoit will be talking about open source routing. Odin Shanun will be talking about packet pacing, rate limiting for per flow TCP UDP, which is definitely interesting. Then Mahai Karavas will be talking about porting Beehive to ARM-based platforms.
Oh, interesting.
Arun Thomas will be talking about the RISC-V, Berkeley hardware for your Berkeley software distribution.
Ooh, Ed Mass doing reproducible builds in FreeBSD.
Yes,
please.
Apparently we're almost there.
There.
Henning Brower will be talking about running an ISP on OpenBSD. Mm-hmm. George Neville Deal will be doing Through the Wire, which is his network performance work.
Okay. John Nielsen's using VXLAN to network virtual machines, jails, and other fun things on FreeBSD.
Yes, that's a great technology for allowing VLANs to actually extend across physical networks. So you can, if you have multiple data centers, you can actually have VLANs that go between them. And it allows you to have more than 4,000 VLANs, which can matter if you're doing virtual machines. If you're running a cloud for other people and you have more than 4,000 customers, you need more than 4,000 VLANs.
Sure.
Yep, Kirk Russell will be doing using competitive analysis to increase the effectiveness of open source system fuzz testing, which will apply to an article we're talking about later in this episode. Then I will be running a ZFS boff, which I'm sure I can.
I got you into one of those too.
Yep, okay. I'm sure I can get Matt Ahrens to come help out with that, answer questions. Mm-hmm. And then Michael Dexter will be talking about Disk CTL, which is a permissively licensed smart and raw disk command framework. So something to replace SmartMonTools/SmartCTL, but also to replace a bunch of the CAM raw commands for doing things like tuning the noise limiting on your hard drive and how soon it goes to sleep, so that it doesn't go to sleep and wake up too frequently. But also, the problem with SmartCTL is the output is very geared towards humans.
Sure.
And it's very hard to script anything with it.
Automate anything.
Yes. Yeah. So a disctl with an option to say output in JSON or even just tab delimited straight text or something would be very useful. And so there's that. And then Luis Otavio Souza will be talking about NetMap Forward, which is
nice.
Basically using NetMap to do routing, which should be really fast.
Okay, so we basically got 48 different things here. Most of them lectures, a couple tutorials, some BOFs, but
yep.
This is going to be a really action-packed BSD CAN.
Yes.
Definitely got to make a point to get out there.
And yes, I really did like to see that there's quite a few people that I haven't seen presenting before mm-hmm. coming out.
Yeah, new folks. That's yep. a great thing.
Yes, hoping to see more new people attending as well. Mm-hmm. Especially more sysadmins. That's what we need at these conferences. Right.
Well, and speaking of, don't forget there's a lot of dev summits that take place. So if you're planning on being there, get there a couple days early. If you're a yes. committer, obviously do the dev summit. If you're not a committer,
tutorials.
Find a committer that's a friend of yours or get signed up. Or
yes, there's
tutorials.
That. Also, there will be, there should be, hopefully, a newbie orientation track thing where you can basically get assigned. If it's your first time to BSD CAN, you'll be able to get assigned a person to help you kind of pick which talks to go to and get you acquainted with, some of us have been going to BSD CAN for quite a few years, more than me even, and know where all the cool spots are. And mm-hmm. If you're very new to a conference, it can be nice to have a conference buddy to that's been there before, knows where all the goodies are,
sure,
and how things work.
Okay, well, great. Well, of mm-hmm. course, we'll look forward to seeing you all there. So try and get all signed up and ready. Yes. Don't leave it to the last minute.
Yes, and like I said, make sure you're there by Tuesday night so that you can come to the Goat Boff.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the talks don't start till Friday.
That's right.
You want to be there on Tuesday because Wednesday and Thursday is full of goodness, and then mm-hmm. Friday and Saturday are the talks, which are even more goodness.
Oh, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yes.
Okay.
It's weird to be so excited about BSD CAN when AsiaBSDCon is next week.
Oh, yeah. Just got to get over the flight first.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot of fun. We'll look forward to seeing some of you there as well. Okay, so what's our next article here? We have something about what does load average really mean?
Yes.
The many load averages of Unix. So mm-hmm. walk us through this one. What are they doing here at the University of Toronto?
Yes. So this is an article from Chris Seibenman, who's a sysadmin at the University of Toronto, and he runs a couple of different operating systems over there. They have some FreeBSD machines, I think they have OpenBSD routers, and then they have some OmniOS based machines for ZFS, and I imagine they have some Linux in there as well. And he looked into it and was like, these load averages don't make any sense. And so he dug into some of the code and tried to figure out what load average actually means. So back in the beginning, by which he means 3BSD, the load average counted how many processes were runnable or in short-term I/O wait, waiting for the disk. The BSD kernel computed this count periodically by walking over the entire process table. You can see this example, and he links to the function in the old 4.2 BSD source code. Unixes that were derived from 4BSD carried this definition forward for load average, which meant SunOS and Alteryx. Sysadmins using NFS back in these days got very familiar with the short-term I/O wait part of load average, because if your NFS server stopped responding, all of your NFS clients would accumulate huge load as more and more processes were stuck waiting for the NFS server.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, technically it wasn't I/O wait, but any process that is sleeping with a non-interoperable priority for less than a second or something like that. He says, when Linux implemented the load average back in 0.96c, it copied the traditional definition from BSD. The Linux load average has been run queue plus short-term I/O wait ever since, although the exact mechanics of how it's computed have changed over time to be more efficient than, once we had multiprocessor systems with large number of processes, walking over the entire process tree every time to calculate this didn't make as much sense anymore.
Sure.
When Sun executed the great Sun OS 4 to Solaris transition, they changed a bunch of things about what load average meant on Solaris. But looking at the Illumos code, he determined that it was too complicated for him to want to figure out exactly how it calculates it for this blog post. But it's different. The situation in the BSDs is even messier. He hasn't thoroughly investigated the historical source trees, but it seems that 386 BSD and the NetBSD didn't immediately change the 4BSD definition. Certainly the FreeBSD 2.0 source code, which he has handy access to via the a GitHub repo, still counts processes in I/O wait. Then at some point, things got very tangled with some of the other available information. He says, at some point, FreeBSD split apart from OpenBSD and NetBSD on load average calculations. And even OpenBSD and NetBSD are somewhat divergent from each other now. Mm-hmm. In FreeBSD, the load average counts only runnable processes, not processes in I/O wait. The count of runnable processes is maintained on the fly by the scheduler, so it doesn't have to walk through the list. So that means on FreeBSD, load average is only about CPU time and doesn't consider processes that are waiting on the disk. On NetBSD, the function counts runnable processes and all sleeping processes that have slept for less than 1 second so far. And in OpenBSD, it says the function appears to count runnable processes and sleeping processes that have a high priority I/O wait and have slept for less than 1 second so far. So this is seemingly fewer sleeping processes than NetBSD counts because it does all I/O wait, whereas OpenBSD only does high priority I/O wait. So it means if you ran the same load on Illumos, Linux, FreeBSD, NetBSD, and OpenBSD, all the load averages would be different.
Interesting.
And he says, don't even ask me what Dragonfly does.
Yeah, not just a little confusing.
Yes. He says, this is all very messy and contradicts some things knowledgeable OpenBSD people have said to me. Mind you, they said them back in 2009, but on the other hand, I can't imagine OpenBSD would have dropped what they were doing, switched to something new, and then restored back to it. But he hasn't dug through all the CVS logs to figure out. And, you know, he didn't even look at what Mac OS X tries to do.
Who knows?
Energetic people are encouraged to do their own research.
Well, we'll have to see if anybody follows up with that.
Yeah.
He's, man, quite different in all the different Unixes.
The nice thing about the way FreeBSD does it, other than the fact that you have to use some other tool to look at, what do you call it, at the I/O stuff, is you can compare load averages between machines with different CPUs and different core counts by basically taking the load average and dividing it by the number of cores. You know, back when I started, having a load average higher than like 3 meant your system was pretty bad, right?
Yeah,
you have one processor and there are always at least 3 programs wanting to use 100% of it. Whereas now, if you have, say, 24 cores, then a load average of 3 means that it's pretty not busy.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to divide the load average by the core count to get an idea of approximately how much time the system spends waiting to be able to do stuff. But
seems like that could be some work done there to improve that or improve the reporting of that, so it's a little more obvious based on cores now.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, definitely interesting. Well, we'll see. Maybe they'll do a follow up. Like, this is how Mac does it. This is how it happens elsewhere. But
yep.
We'll see what happens.
It'd be more interesting to try to figure out a standard of what is actually useful to measure.
True. True. Okay, so as a follow-up to a story last week, we had mentioned last week's episode how Ubuntu was preparing to release their next version with native ZFS support, and we had heard that the Software Freedom Conservancy was working on a statement dealing with that, and as expected, they did issue one detailing some of the legal argument on why they believe this is a violation of the GPL for Linux kernel. So we have a link to the article here in the show notes, and it's a pretty darn long and complete article, so you may want to take a chance to read through that. But we wanted to just kind of touch on a little bit of the summary they posted here and, of course, encourage you to read the rest, since it's good to be knowledgeable about the various open source projects and, of course, licensing conditions and whatnot. And, hey, if you're developing something, this may affect you. So good to be a little bit boned up on this. But we'll just share, of course, the summary here. And then we have a counterpoint from the Software Freedom Law site as well. So we'll get to that. But first, their summary, they said, we're sympathetic to Canonical's frustration and this desire to easily support more features for their users. However, as set out below, we have concluded that their distribution of ZFS.ko violates the GPL. We have written this statement to answer, from the point of view of many key Linux copyright holders, the community questions that we've seen on this matter. Specifically, we provide our detailed analysis of the incompatibility between the CDDL v1 and GPL v2 as its potential impact on the trajectory of free software development below. They said, however, our conclusion is simple. the Conservancy and Linux copyright holders in the GPL compliance project for Linux developers believe that the distribution of ZFS binaries is a GPL violation and infringes Linux copyright. We are also concerned that it may infringe Oracle's copyrights in ZFS. As such, we again ask Oracle to respect community norms against license proliferation and simply relicense its copyrights in ZFS under a GPL v2 compatible license. What would you place the chances of that happening at?
Well, unofficially, I've heard that somebody offered Oracle at least $100 million to do that, and we're told to go fly a kite.
Well, if they offered that kind of money and Oracle said, take a hike, I think that puts the odds next to zero.
Yeah. But
yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, we'll, of course, keep you up to date. So what was the counterpoint on this here, Alan?
Yes. So the Software Freedom Law Center, which kind of works at a different angle from where the Software Conservancy is about protecting the rights of the license and the license holders, the people that actually write the kernel. Mm-hmm. Software Freedom Law Center is more about providing services to the people that are having to do stuff with the license and interpretation and so on. But they basically detail how there's this licensing file in the Linux kernel that specifically takes the stance that as far as the GPL goes, anything that's in user land is not considered to be a derived work of the Linux kernel. So basically, collectively, the people that run that build Linux have made the statement that this is how we interpret this part of the license to make it clear for people to use it. And so, if the kernel developers feel that a kernel module like the ZFS one isn't violating their copyright, then they can update that license file to include a statement about that. And then that way people can be less worried about it. And anyway, it's a long article with all the legal arguments and basically talks about how this isn't the first time that this kind of thing has come up. Right? Sure. The Andrew file system module, which is, I think, from IBM, it's from a university. I think it's Carnegie Mellon? I forget. Anyway, has a similar problem. And there's, obviously all the graphics drivers and a bunch of other modules that are kind of in the same situation. The interesting thing here is that the license for the CDDL allows you to make a binary out of it and actually distribute that binary as a GPL v2 licensed binary. That's allowed under the CDDL. The problem is the GPL license says that if you make a binary and license it GPL, you have to license the source code as GPL.
Sure.
And the CDDL doesn't allow you to impose additional restrictions on the CDDL license, which the GPL does. And so it's this very confusing thing where actually the problem isn't the CDDL license, it's maybe the GPL license.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, if you want to learn more about it and read the legal opinions, you should check out this blog from the softwarefreedom.org.
Okay. And I guess the FreeBSD Foundation issued something as well.
Yes, so we'll get to that one in a sec. And then the other one is James Bottomley, who's the Linux SCSI subsystem maintainer. And so, probably has something to do, some interest in storage systems and file systems and so on. So he has a blog post about this saying, Canonical recently threw this issue into sharp relief with their decision to ship CDL licensed ZFS. There's much legal wrangling about this at this point, but he says their finding that it's not a derivative work is somewhat unconvincing because there are other people have done similar things and got in trouble for it. Sure. But in general, for license compliance, it really comes down to in tort law in the U.S. That you have to actually show that someone was harmed. And how do they do that for this particular case? Because I don't know that the people with the GPL, the Linux kernel developers are not necessarily harmed by ZFS being available to people. But yeah, so yet another different perspective on the issue. Worth a read if you're interested. And then yes, the FreeBSD Foundation put up a post and they're basically said for nearly 7 years now, FreeBSD has included a production quality ZFS implementation, and it's kind of become a key feature of FreeBSD. And the nice thing is that the two clause liberal copy free license, the BSD license, allows you to interact with other licenses without too much trouble. Sure. Really,
this is one of those situations where really the only people who win are the lawyers.
Yes,
they get to bill a lot for this kind of crap. So interesting. Okay, well, we have all the links to that in our show notes, of course, so take a look if you're interested in some of the legal wrangling that's happening behind the scenes. And of course we'll keep an eye on that as it unfolds. Okay, so next we have some Dragonfly news. It looks like their i915 driver, man, that thing just keeps on flying, but they have updated it to match Linux kernel 4.2 for the Intel DRM KMS driver. So, of course, various improvements, better support for new hardware.
Like Bridwell and Skylake. It's not complete. I don't think Skylake was perfect in Linux until 4.4, which is like literally only a month old or something. But this definitely improves the support for that.
Yeah, so I guess one big difference they're saying is that Dragonfly BSD does not require the binary firmware blob that Linux uses. So Francois Churgeau explains that starting from Linux 4.2, there's a separate firmware blob that's required to save and restore the state of just some display engines in some low-power modes. These low-power modes have been forcibly disabled in Dragonfly's version of the driver so they can keep it blob-free, which seems like a good trade-off. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, well, while that has some disadvantages, it's not a feature that anybody in Dragonfly has ever had, so they're not likely to miss it.
Yeah, true. We didn't take anything away from you. We just didn't add this thing.
Yeah. That's and a
good way to go.
I can see some Linux distros probably deciding to do the same thing.
Sure.
If they want to be blob-free. But I don't know if these low-power modes mean, like, while it's running... And, like, you know, it's just the video card kind of half goes to sleep in the background. Or if it's, you know, when you actually, like, suspend. It's like, well, if you're suspended, you're not really using much power at all, right?
True. No idea. But anyway, it seems like keep an eye on that, see what happens. But, yeah, good job, guys. That's awesome. They are, man, just flying on that stuff.
Yeah, although I hear that the update, the 3.8, is it, for FreeBSD is almost done.
It's close to hitting Fabricator, from what I understand. It's close. Like, I guess they fixed some of the last regressions.
Yeah, there was a big
3.9 and so
bug in that they nailed. And, yeah, if they can, hopefully each one successive one is a little bit easier, and we can catch up.
It'll kind of snowball there, right?
Yep.
Once they get enough of the back end change where it's easier to pull from upstream.
Yep.
So, cool. Okay, so before we get into our interview, it's time to mention our first sponsor this week, which we're going to be starting with DigitalOcean. Of course, that's digitalocean.com. You can go create an account, put a couple bucks in there, and heck, for $5 a month, you can start running their low-end VM. And, I mean, that's backed by SSDs, a terabyte of transfer. It'll natively support FreeBSD. You, of course, can do Linux on it. If you want to get a little more adventurous, you can install OpenBSD on it or
NetBSD.
NetBSD as well. Yep. So,
you get a
definitely very cool.
You get a full HTML5 console that's basically equivalent to like BIOS level access. So you can, you know, interrupt the boot and use your script or whatever and basically overwrite whatever's on the disk with whatever else you want.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And there's guides out there for how to do that. You can search past episodes of BSD Now if you want to find those links. But definitely the info's out there on how to do that. It should just be an easy walkthrough to follow. But don't forget, if you're signing up with a new account and you haven't used any other coupon codes, you can use FreeBSD Now as your coupon code. And that'll give you a $10 credit, which, of course, is good for running a VM for 2 months if you're using that lower-end one, which is a great way if you're just getting set up and you don't really have to put any money out at that point. You can just try it out, get it set up, and after that, $5 a month for that sucker.
Yeah, well, with any of the BSDs, 512 megs of RAM is enough to run the OS and a couple of services that you're going to stick in this thing.
I'm doing it, and I got 3 jails running on it.
Yeah. That's the nice thing about jails, right?
Yeah, very lightweight. So, yeah, I've got 3 separate jails running 3 separate things, and it works very well. So I cannot complain at that price. I mean, shoot.
Yeah.
That's like one trip to Starbucks half the time, or less than a trip to Starbucks. So anyway, it is a good deal. So go check it out today, guys, digitalocean.com. Don't forget that coupon code. Take a look at their great FAQs. They got a lot of good information, tutorials, walkthroughs on how to do different things to get you set up, and you'll be flying in no time.
Yeah, make sure to consider where to put your VM. You have East Coast and West Coast of the U.S., Canada, England, Germany, Netherlands, and Singapore to pick from. On top of private networking, if you have multiple VMs, you can actually network them in the back end and transfer data for free between them, not counting against your bandwidth quota. Not that your bandwidth quota isn't healthy enough with a terabyte included with the $5 one and 2 terabytes with the $10 one, and all the stuff you might need. Has a great uptime SLA, reverse DNS management, so it even works great for mail servers and stuff. Everything you might need is all there.
Great. Well, go get signed up today and let us know what you're using it for. I'm sure there's all kinds of crazy things you guys are doing.
Our guest this week is Jamie McParland, technology supervisor at the Newburgh Public Schools in Oregon. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started with BSD?
The computer journey that I've been on has been a long one. It started out in the early 90s. I lived with a roommate who bought a Macintosh, and I wanted to play with it. And he said that I'm not allowed to touch this computer until I read all the manuals. So I read all the Quark Express and Photoshop books that he had, and eventually he let me play with it. And so from there, I got a job as a graphic designer at a newspaper. And while I was there, we had no IT department, and I was the only person that was interested in how the computers actually worked. And so by, de facto became the IT guy there and moved out to Oregon, started working at a hardware repair shop doing Macintosh repairs. And then one of the guys I worked with at the hardware place came to the school district here. They had OS X server 10.0, which is basically next step with the classic Mac OS interface on it, and they were having some problems with it, and they called me out to help with it. I had no idea what I was doing, but I was able to solve the problem, and they offered me a job, and that's kind of where I got started with the server software and that sort of thing. So when I came to the district, we had no firewall and three Class C subnets, no DHCP server, and everything was, manually assigned IP addresses. It was written down on a legal pad which computer had which IP address. And so from there, I kind of jumped in with both feet. We had some donated hardware, and I said, you guys, we have to put a firewall in. And we installed OpenBSD on it, and we've been, BSD and other open source software ever since. So
cool. So that's how that was your first introduction to using BSD?
Pretty much, yeah. OpenBSD firewall for a school district. Mm-hmm. It's a trial by fire.
Yep.
Just jump in with both feet and make sure the internet works. Luckily, back in 2000 when I started here, we only had a few computer labs. So, when I did break the internet by misconfiguring OpenBSD, it wasn't the end of the world like it is nowadays. Right. So, yeah.
Cool. So tell us a little bit about the school district. How large is it?
For Oregon, we're a medium-sized school district. We have about 5,000 students, 550 staff. Technology-wise, we have between physical and virtual servers, we have about 65 servers. We own about, 4,000 to 5,000 devices, with Android tablets, iPads, Chromebooks, Mac laptops, PC laptops, that sort of thing. About 4,000 to 5,000 devices. We're working on going one-to-one by the year 2020. So every kid will have a device. And our network, about 10,000 IP devices on our network. So, with BYOD and, everything's connected to the internet now, HVAC, all that stuff. So about 10,000 devices on the network. And we have a tech department staff of 4 people. So a lot of devices for us to take care of, but I got an amazing crew of guys that work with me. So, that's
cool. So you can tell us a little bit about the mixture of technologies that you have behind the scenes to run all that?
Yeah. We basically, the tech department, it's everything you can imagine, networking and switches, enterprise wireless, we terminate fiber, fixing network drops, deal with, internet filtering, mail servers, phishing attacks, You know, for server stuff, we're all over the board. VMware, Linux, Microsoft, FreeNAS, OpenBSD, FreeBSD. We host a lot of like education apps in-house. And so, yeah, it's just basically, you know, if it uses electricity, we're responsible for it. Yep. So, you know, it's nice because it keeps things interesting. You know, one call could be about fax machine not working. The next call could be about, you know, kids and getting into websites they're not supposed to and that sort of stuff. And then the next call could be, you know, an angry parent. So, yeah, it's definitely a wide variety of stuff that we mm-hmm. do here.
So one of the ones we heard about when we asked you to come on the show was switching away from Nexenta devices for storage to FreeNAS a couple of years ago. So what prompted that?
So, you know, I've been here 16 years now, and it's like this like continuous integration of technology here. In the early 2000s, we had Linux boxes with hardware RAID. You know, for our clients, for a lot of years, we did K-12 LTSP, so Linux terminals. We had about 800 of them at one point. And so we have a lot of little files. Mm-hmm. And trying to do backups, you know, we were using rsync. And at the time, rsync needed to walk the tree every yep. time, you know, walk the directory. And so, you know, backups were taking 24 hours, you know, so the... it just wasn't possible. So we needed to move to like block level replication. That's when we started to hear about ZFS and looked into it. We went with Nexenta and it worked pretty well. We really like ZFS, but Nexenta, we really wanted to have a bunch of nodes for redundancy, and with the licensing, you know, in a K-12 school district where, you know, mm-hmm. we're just so underfunded. The licensing costs were killing us. And Nexenta is kind of like a weird mix of Solaris and Debian or something. I'm not exactly yeah. sure. So it was a little odd for us to deal with. And so at that point, you know, we'd heard FreeBSD was getting ZFS. And so we looked into vanilla FreeBSD and NetBSD and ultimately tested out FreeNAS and decided on FreeNAS.
Cool. And so how's that been?
It's been great. You know, it's interesting because everything you think you know about storage is kind of turned on its head when you deal with ZFS. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want a RAID card. You want a HBA and you need tons of RAM and lots of spindles and that sort of thing. So, but yeah, FreeNAS has been amazing.
Right. So you're using it to store the backups or to store the primaries so that you can replicate them more?
So all of our storage is done on FreeNAS. Our VMware virtual machines are stored on FreeNAS. All our user storage, group storage, security camera footage, you name it. Anything that needs storage is put on the FreeNAS.
That's quite a mix of different workloads, actually.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And you know, and like, you know, going back to the Nexenta thing, we try to separate out those workloads if we can, you know, when you need long security camera footage.
It's just,
you know,
where simple, it's just straight, append only.
Yeah. Right. But then when you have 5,000 students that are using LTSP and they have, you know, billions of little tiny preference files in their home folder, that's a whole different data yep. set, you know, to deal with. So... the last time I checked in our group storage, we had 1.1 million files and our user storage was at 12.8 million files. So not huge file sizes, but just so many little files. And, you know, being able to do that block level replication has been
yeah.
a game changer for us.
Yeah. So how do you set up your FreeNAS boxes to ensure failover and reliability?
We don't do any automated failover, mm-hmm. You know, not necessarily in FreeNAS, but in other things, I've found automated failover a lot of times can cause more failures than prevent them. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big fan of what I call warm failover, you know, where everything's set up, but it takes human intervention to
actually like throw the switch.
Exactly. Yeah. So, Right now, we have 7 FreeNAS servers, over 150 hard drives. Most of them are 7200 RPM SAS drives set up as mirrors. And almost all our servers have 2 pools. The live pool sends snapshots to the secondary pool every 15 minutes. And then we also have a third backup off-site. So
That's a good setup. So what does your off-site data recovery plan look like?
Like I said, all our storage is free NAS. And, you know, being here for as long as I have, and it's, I kind of feel like anything that could possibly go wrong has gone wrong.
At least once.
You know, over the years, yeah. You know, and the thing about data loss is data loss doesn't need to be a natural disaster like a flood or a fire. You know, we've had misconfigured AC units in the server room that were turned off over a long weekend, and like the email alerts didn't happen, you know. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I live an hour away from my office, and twice we've had contractors come in over a break and test the Halon system. Well, what they did was they turned off the main breaker in the data center. I start getting alerts from the UPS, but nobody's at the office except for the contractors. And so I'm driving down here in a mad rush, and I get here and, you know, the whole data center's powered off, you know. And I think a lot of people don't like to admit, but, you know, admin error, you know, when you work long hours, you can be tired and totally fat finger something. You know, one time I added a device to a pool that I didn't mean to, and then I couldn't remove it,
yep.
You know? And so it's like, you know, that pool is basically toast. And so even all the redundancy that's built into FreeNAS or, you know, and into ZFS, you can totally goof it up. And, you know, so that's why, I have these extra pools laying around, you know, for when, non-natural disasters happen. You know, I think a lot of people don't think about restore times. Yeah. You know, if you have more than a few terabytes of data, it can take days to restore over gig.
Yeah.
And, you know, our network is busy and important, you know. Nowadays we have, you know, I mean, all our phones, our security cameras, the lights in the parking lot of the, you know, of the high school, you know, even the toilet flushing at some of the schools is controlled by the network. And so I, you know, if the network's down, school closes. So I can't, you know, eat up our whole pipe to our backup data center, you know, restoring terabytes of data. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the network has other important things to do. So,
and it would take a week.
It would take a long time. Yeah. So luckily, I believe next year we're trying to get dark fiber run from our primary data center to our secondary. So we'll have a 10 gig connection there, which is going to be awesome. But, you know, in talking about our recovery plan, one thing that we do that I think is a little odd is our group storage. So all our user shares are NFS, and they're snapshotted every 15 minutes, sent to the second pool and then sent to the offsite pool. The group shares are interesting because there's a 16 group membership limit for NFS version 3. Mm-hmm. So we share our groups storage out via iSCSI to a SMB server. But, you know, some people will accidentally delete a file or a folder, and they want, you know, a single file or folder restored. And it's a pain to, you know, go through 15 minute snapshots of iSCSI, you know,
right.
Volumes. And so, you know, we snapshot the iSCSI extents. What we do is we'll rsync the group data to our offsite data center, and then also snapshot that. And then that way, so you know, we're able to restore the iSCSI extent if disaster strikes. But, you know, if some user accidentally deletes a file, we're able to grab, you know, we have multiple revisions of those groups files. So, yeah, I think that's pretty handy.
Yeah, I can see how, you know, bulk restoring the iSCSI extent is good for that case. But for the individual file case, having the, you know, file system level rsync type thing makes more sense.
Right, yeah. You know, it only took two times of a user needing a single file to where I had to mount the iSCSI extents and look in it and then unmount it and then mount the
try one 50 you know, minutes older. And like, it's like, well, when was the last time it was there?
Yeah, it's like, you know what? This is an awful idea. We need to solve this. So, yeah, we've definitely got it solved now.
So we also heard that you use external JBODs to store your disk in at the offsite data center.
Yeah, we actually use external JBODs everywhere. And, you know, this is where ZFS really shines and is awesome. You know, you can just pick up a JBOD and move the disk shelf. You know, sometimes hardware has a problem, but the drives in the pool are okay. And so you can just plug that into a different head unit. You know, if you want to upgrade a server, you just buy a new head unit, stress test it. Make sure it's good, and then just plug your existing pool into it. So, you know, it's really nice to, you know, have that stuff tested before it's put into production, and literally it's just plugging and then doing a zpool import. You know, and another thing we do is, you know, we only have a gig connection between our data centers, and so if we lose the primary and, this, and the secondary, you know, depending on the estimated restore time, we can a lot of times physically drive to the offsite data center, pick up that JBOD, bring it back to the main data center, and then make it the primary pool. You know, and I think an important thing for us is that, you know, a lot of people back up the tape or whatever, but with multi-terabytes, you know, we've decided we want to back up to stuff that can become the primary. Right. And, you know, I don't know that a lot of people think that.
Exactly.
You know, because restore times are insane. So.
Well, yeah, you know, we had to do the same thing at Scale Engine because, like, well, each of our storage things is like 100 terabytes. It's like even if we did pay the extra to go from 1 gig to 10 gig for our link between the two data centers, it would still take forever.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And we need so restore time in hours.
Right, yeah. You know, and a lot of times, you know, it's basically going back to the old sneaker now. Mm-hmm. You know, we just literally drive over there, pick up the JBOD, put it in my hatchback, drive it back, you know, mount it up, plug in the SAS cable, do a zpool import, change some NFS share settings, and we're rocking and rolling in, you know, 20 minutes compared to, you know, what could have been 2 days. Yeah. So.
Exactly. You know, otherwise, it gets pretty insane, you know. You're not going to be able to do 582 gigabytes per second that you can get with a car and a JBOD full of disks.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, even if you do have, you know, 10 gig or whatever, you know, that's assuming that your stuff goes down at 7 o'clock at night and you have 6 hours to do the restore. You know, if this happens at 3 a.m. and school starts at 6, 7 a.m.
Yep.
You know, you have such a short window, so doing a restore is not an option. And telling people, you know, hey, you can't log into your machines because none of your home directories are available isn't an option either, you know. So I got to make this stuff work, and this has worked out really well for us. So,
yeah. So have you had to deal with any CryptoLocker-style malware or ransomware?
You know, not a lot of it. Once on a group share, we were notified, and we were, you know, once we were notified, we were able to do a ZFS rollback and have their files back in 2 minutes. You know, I read all these like horror stories about people getting hit with this stuff, and it, you know, it makes me crazy because there's an awesome open source solution to deal with this, just waiting for you to download it and read a book on it and, you know, put it into production. This is just, it's just frustrating because it seems so avoidable, you know? And so for us, when it happened, it was just like, cool, we get to, you know, see if this is going to work, and it totally worked. And it was such a non-issue for us. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying bring it on by any means, but you know, it's not one of the things that I lose sleep over. I'll say that.
Yeah. Well, because the nice thing with something like ZFS means you can, clone the snapshot from before you got CryptoLockered and swap the mount point and get that running, and everybody's happy. But you can still actually keep the version that has some of the files CryptoLocker in order to individually extract a couple of files that maybe were updated between the last snapshot and hadn't got hit yet or whatever. And,
right, yeah.
You know, with any other type of system, you don't really get that. And, you know, I actually saw it at the college where I was consulting for a while. They were talking about, oh, yeah, the, you know, the one of our offsite campuses got hit with the CryptoLocker, and we're saturating our point-to-point link, trying to restore the backups, right. But it'll be down for another, like, 7 hours. I'm like,
right.
What are you doing? ZFS rollback. Yeah. Problem solved.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you know, if you're snapshotting, you know, every 15, I mean, you can snapshot as fast as, mm-hmm. you know, you can snapshot once a minute if you wanted, you know, but I find 15 minutes for us works really well, yep. And, you know, bang, we're back in action so fast, it's ridiculous, so.
Yeah, so did you get any organizational pushback to trying to use open source software for some of this stuff instead of something commercial?
No, surprisingly enough, you know, most schools are broke, and you know, I find that anyone usually wanting to put a non-open source software into production is a lot of times is the technology department. You know, that the administrators of the school are more than happy for us to use software that's doesn't cost this, you know, school district any money. So. You know, it trickled in here, you know, with, you know, starting with a firewall, and then we, you know, got Squid up and running to do filtering, to be in compliance with the, you know, the feds, because we get some funding for doing internet filtering, mm-hmm. You know, and then we set up a mail, you know, a listserv, and we just kind of piece by piece just added open source stuff, and everybody was super psyched on it. And so now, you know, even though we have VMware and we have some Microsoft stuff, you know, we use Active Directory and that sort mm-hmm. of thing. We, you know, if we can put it in anywhere, you know, that's what we try to, that's our first call. And, yeah, the administration really likes it. So, and, you know, also, you know, we had K-12 LTSP, so Linux terminals for years, we had 800 or 900 of them. And it, you know, it was, these were machines that were no longer fast enough to run Windows mm-hmm. with. And it's like, hey, you know, if we spent, you know, a couple of grand, you know, it was like $3,000 on a couple of servers, I can give, you know, we can have 800 more kids on computers. And, you know, the administration was all over it. So, yeah, open source software has definitely been a positive impact here for a school district.
That's good. So was there anything else you wanted to mention?
Yeah, you know, I would encourage school districts to play with FreeNAS, FreeBSD, ZFS, you know, buy the the FreeBSD Mastery ZFS book is really good. I know you had something to do with that. I enjoyed it. You know, and if you can, you know, take the money that you would have spent on an EMC or, you know, some other crazy, ridiculously expensive SAN, you know, contact IX system you know, it really makes sense, you know, and also, you know, I'd say do the math on restore times, you know, and if you can do a restore.
Exactly.
You
know, that's a big one.
Make sure that's, you know, it's a stressful time when that happens. You don't want to find out that, oh yeah, we overlooked something, you know, so.
And usually, even when you overlook something, there's some way around it, but it just always goes better if it's something that you've practiced, right? It's like a fire drill.
Right.
They do fire drills at schools all the time, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, it's funny. Those things always go off, and I always think, do I have to go out on those too? You know. So, anyways, but you know, and I would also tell people, you know, if you only have one backup, you don't have a backup.
Yep. If there are not three copies of it, it doesn't actually exist.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and I would say, you know, if you do go the ZFS route, you know, coming from a hardware RAID background. You know, you're going to need to throw out everything that you think you know about storage and, you know, listen to the people online, use HBAs, not RAID cards, buy more RAM than you can afford, you know, and remember lots of spindles.
Yes. So, well, and that's the advantage to using something like FreeNAS versus an EMC is you can afford to build the primary, the backup, and the remote backup in the same budget you would have spent on the one EMC.
Exactly. And, you know, it's not like they're using some sort of special magic parts that aren't available to the general public. And so, you know, they're using Xeon processors, they're using Seagate hard drives, you know. So, you know, you can do that too. To wrap up, I love the show. I've been listening since episode one.
Thank you.
I'm a Tarsnap user. Thanks to you guys. I wanted to say, I wanted to thank you for your work on ZXFer. That's offered us some extra flexibility that we really needed, mm-hmm. That we couldn't get with the vanilla free NAS. Also shout out to Michael Dexter, yes. and his consulting services at Gainframe. There's been many a Friday night where I've called him freaking out, and he's been super helpful and definitely a positive and great resource for us to have. And the guys in the FreeNAS IRC channel have been great too, so lots of great community support on this stuff. There are some enterprise things that we pay really expensive support contracts for, and I think we probably get better support with FreeBSD and FreeNAS, on the forums and IRC and people like Michael Dexter and that sort of thing than we do from any support, enterprise support contract that we pay for. Right. So very positive.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for coming and talk to us and letting us know.
Thanks for having me. Keep up the good work. I love the show.
Thank you.
Okay, hope you guys enjoyed the interview. We're back. We got a busy news roundup to get to, Beastie Bits and some comments and questions. But before we do that, let's mention the next sponsor this week, which is going to be IX Systems. So, of course, the website for that, ixsystems.com/BSDnow. Go there, fill out the information, get in touch with the guys over at IX, and let them build your next dream system. Or if you need a dozen of them or more, of course, they'll do that for you. They can do everything tiny down to a FreeNAS mini up to these powerhouse systems we've shown. I think, what was it, last week had that system with 96 8-terabyte hard drives. Did we ever figure out 90. The math on what that – 90? Did we ever figure out the math on what kind of Z-pool that turned into?
Well, if you just do raw storage without the Z-pool, that'll be 720 terabytes. Depending how you create the Z pool, that'll be, different.
A lot.
Yes.
A lot. So more than I'll ever see in my lifetime sitting in my shed. So anyway, that was really cool. And of course, IX Systems hardware is all built with the latest and greatest Intel processors, and they can do all manner and make of those. I know Alan had a special one where you're doing some video stuff. So they were able to find the right processor to match for you there. Mm-hmm. So they can definitely, of course, build the system to your specs and, of course, to meet whatever goal it is you're trying to achieve.
Exactly.
Performance, et cetera. So don't just say, hey, I want this hardware. Tell them what you're doing.
Yes, they have all kinds of advice.
Yeah, they do a lot of this, and they understand a lot of what you're running. These aren't your typical sales guys where they can sell you the hardware, but they don't really know anything about the software side of it. If you tell them what you're doing on the software side of it, they will help make sure you get the right hardware to do what it is you're trying to do.
Because, if it's like, oh, well, I'm buying SSDs, but I'm planning to do it as an L2 ARC or ZIL or just for the OS, well, for all three of those, you actually want a different SSD.
That's right. And it's not just for BSD. I mean, they'll sell systems with Linux as well.
Yes, a lot of actually. With Linux, we have came in through one of the Reddits here. Somebody just got their new IX Systems mail server. Now, they'll be running Linux on it, but, that's allowed if you really
want to. We'll forgive
you
this time.
Yeah, and they got pictures here. You can see they got the fancy box, and there's the machine. You can see four network cards plus this dedicated IPMI on the back, some USB 2 and 3 ports, serial and VGA, and nice IX Systems logo there in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
That is really cool.
Yeah, and there's nice zoom in system. On the ports and the logo. Mm-hmm. There it is, all plugged in and lit up.
Nice. Well, hey, that could be your system next. Don't just get jealous at looking at these pictures. Like, call up today and get that next system ordered so that can be sent to your office or your data center or wherever you need it. Of course, heck, if you need a home system and you want to call up and get a FreeNAS Mini, they make great Christmas presents. So think about that for the upcoming year as well.
Well, even this machine here, you can see, because it's just a mail server, it's a 1U and it's short depth, so it doesn't take up a lot of space. Mm-hmm. This is very similar to the machine I bought for... to be my router. This one has the I/O ports on the front, but mine has it on the back. But you know, I needed 4 1-gigabit network cards and you know, a reasonable processor, but nothing too fancy. But I wanted something that was not going to take up a lot of space and not make too much noise, and they managed to build me one.
That's great. Well, of course, they can do that for you guys, too. So, again, ixsystems.com/BSDnow. Go get in touch with them. Mm-hmm. And, hey, if you order something, send some pictures, because we like to show those off. It's always neat to show off new gear. Okay, so first up in the news roundup, we have installing Elk on FreeBSD. We have a tutorial on a couple parts here. So are you an Elk user? Are you interested in becoming one? If so, Gruppo Utini has a nice blog post slash tutorial on how to get started with it on FreeBSD. So first of all, you know, I had to look this up, but in case you haven't heard of Elk, it's not the Elk imports. That's something else. In this case, he's talking about a stack, referring to Elasticsearch, Logstash, and Kibana as a stack together. Yep. So just to clarify, don't just go type package install Elk and, oh, I'm done. Like, this is something different.
Yep.
But anyway, getting started is actually relatively easy. He walks you through it in the first blog post here. It's just a few different packages he's installing. In this case, you have TextProc, Elasticsearch, SysUtils Logstash, TextProc, Kibana 4.3, and for good measure, of course, we have good old trusty Nginx thrown in the mix here.
Mm-hmm.
After he gets those packages installed, he shows you how to enable the various services. Although, hey, come on, it's
SysRC.
You know, 2016, SysRC may be a lot easier. You don't have to be echoing long things to rc.conf anymore. Mm-hmm. So just a heads up on that. He then takes us through the configuration of Elasticsearch and Logstash. For the most part, pretty straightforward. Doesn't look like super complicated config files. But the nice thing is he has the full files available on the site. So you can just copy and paste the examples he provides as well if you just want to get up and running really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in the first blog post. So the follow-up is the second part here, where he takes us now through the K part of Elk, which is going to be setting up Kibana. And, of course, exposing it via Nginx for the public consumption side of it. So at this point, though, most of the CLI work he had to do is finished. So the next step is doing a walkthrough of setting up Kibana via their website, web-driven UI. Which, of course, it's nice that he has a lot of pictures of that. So you can see exactly where you need to go and click. And after you get that all set up, I guess there's a final entry to the blog series that we're waiting for, where he's going to show setting up Elastalert. And, of course, we'll bring that to your attention when it lands. Mm-hmm. Of course, it'll probably be in where Tokyo, so maybe you want to check out the site before then if you're watching this while we're out of town.
Yes, I'm interested in seeing more pictures of the actual graphs you generate with this and so on.
Mm-hmm. That is awesome. But, yeah, definitely take a look at that if you'd like to set that up. I may have to give that a whirl. Man, there's just not enough time to do all these things. You know, you guys think, you know, we're all BSD experts and we have time to do everything. We don't. There's a lot of this stuff I see and I'm like, that looks really cool. I wish I had
love to do
hour
that.
To sit down and play with something like that. So you guys make me jealous. But anyway, this is really cool. Check it out if you do have the time and you can mess around with that. Okay, so what's this next study we have here all the way from back from 89? What's going on, Alan?
This is an empirical study of the reliability of Unix utilities. Which is done by AT&T and Wisconsin University. And so basically they took all the, you know, basic shallow command line utilities that are built into Unixes back in the day and fuzz tested them. Basically they wrote a little program that would inject various streams of gibberish into these programs and see what happens to them.
Interesting. Okay.
All right. So they wrote, you know, fuzz, which generates random input strings, and then the PTY jig, which is for testing interactive programs. So it pretends to be a user and, you know, just
mashes on the keyboard.
Roll your face across the keyboard, basically. Yes.
Yeah.
And then they wrote some scripts to automate the tests and ran the tests and saw what happened. Basically looking for programs that crash, programs that hang, or programs that actually work properly.
Okay.
And so they tested a couple of different machines. So they had a DEC VAX Station 3200, which has a CVAX processor and was running 4.3 BSD plus NFS. They had a Sun 4/110, which had a Spark processor and was running SunOS 3.2. And they also ran the same machine, but with SunOS 4.0 with NFS to compare the difference between the two. Mm-hmm. They had an HP Bobcat 9000 320 and 330, which have slightly different processors, and they ran 4.3 BSD plus NFS on those, but also with the System 5 shared memory support, which was a new feature back then, apparently. Hmm. Then they had a Citrix 8386, which is an i386 processor, and they ran SCO-Zenix System 5 release 2.3.1. Then they had an IBM RT PC, which ran on a ROMP processor and had AAOS Unix. And then an IBM PS280, which is an i386 with AIX 1.1 Unix. And nice. Sequenti Symmetra, which is an i386 running Dynex 3.0. You have to remember, this is all pre, like, 1991, the start of NetBSD and FreeBSD and so on. So a lot of these are like, you know, they have the stock Berkeley one and then some commercial Unixes. Mm. They say the test coverage covered a total of 88 utilities for the 7 different versions of Unix. Most utilities were tested on each system, although a couple of them didn't work or didn't exist. So you can see each utility here is listed and then shows the different OS or machine type. And the different character there indicates what happened when they ran through the fuzzer. They have, if it's a black dot, it means the utility crashed. You can see there's quite a bit of crashing going on. The white circle means that it hung. A star indicates that it crashed on SunOS 3.2, but not on SunOS 4.0, which means an improvement. The kind of circle with the plus sign in it means it crashed on SunOS 4, but not on 3.2. which means a regression. And a dash means the utility doesn't actually exist on that version of the system. And an exclamation mark say the utility managed to crash the entire operating system.
Oh, even better. Yay.
Yeah. I think there's only one of those. But yeah, you can see they have quite a few commands, some of which don't actually exist anymore. Some you've heard of, like, you know, grep and join and latex and lint. But, you know, a couple of these I don't think exist anymore.
Sure.
But basically they ran them through all kinds of stuff. Oh yeah, here's more utilities, you know, make, mail, m4, more, plot, you know, split, sql, strings, telnet, wc. Nobody managed to crash wc. That's good.
No, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah, and they show that
very well written.
You know, each OS, they managed to crash about 25% of the apps on them, except for, oops, I didn't see which OS this column is. I think it's HP. Yeah, the HP managed to crash about 33%.
Hmm.
And it was the, oops, missed it here, the Sequent one where they actually managed to crash the entire system when they tried to run, I think that was refer. Yeah, I'm not sure what the refer utility did back then, but.
No idea.
Yeah. So yeah, they tried injecting printable and non-printable characters with some null characters at 1,000 bytes, 10,000 bytes, and 100,000 bytes. Then they did printable characters with null bytes, and then both printable, not printable, and printable with and without null bytes.
Mm-hmm.
And tried all the different versions of that, and ran all these utilities.
Very cool.
So this is definitely interesting. It's, you know, they talk about some of the differences between the what the processor makes a difference in some of the cases and so on, and what they managed to break and so on.
Okay.
And some of them they categorized, when they actually did get crashes, they categorized them by what caused it, which is also interesting, and so on. And then what's interesting about this is, you know, fuzz testing is still finding problems in some of these programs that you wouldn't think of looking at, right?
I wonder how many of those bugs have persisted over all this time.
Yeah, I don't know. But every once in a while, we still find new ones. And, you know, we've seen recently, actually, quite a few fixes coming up through using a program called AFL, or American Fuzzy LOP, which is a program that I think it looks at the source code to generate a list of the places in the source code it wants to test. So instead of just banging output at the input, it actually, you know, attempts to cause, you know, this variable to be get set to an invalid value and see what happens in the program and so on.
Sure.
And find more of these crashes and let the let them get fixed ahead of time before they cause a problem. But yeah, they have details about all the different causes, you know, race conditions, signed characters versus unsigned characters, and undetermined errors, and so on.
Hmm.
So, you know, if you're new to Unix and don't want to make all the same mistakes, it's definitely a good place to read and get started from.
Okay. Well, cool. Mm-hmm. Hey, I know we mentioned Google Summer of Code, and it's time to get ideas out there so we can get prepped for it. So it looks like both FreeBSD and NetBSD are going to be organizations participating this year. They're going to be running the 2016 Google Summer of Code projects. And we have a couple dates to go along with that. Mm-hmm. So students, you can start submitting proposals on March 14th. So that's a little less than 2 weeks from right now.
The Monday we get back from Tokyo.
Yeah, so don't delay. You won't, you know, have a lot of time. So start thinking of that, about those things now. Because I think, what do they give you, like a week and a half to do the proposal? I remember it being a short window.
Just a reminder, you know, conferences love to have Google Summer of Code students come out and present. I know
that's true.
Last year at AJBSDCon, I think at least two Google Summer of Code students got free trips to Tokyo to come and tell us about the work they did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
keep that in mind. Yeah. You can turn that into doing stuff all throughout the rest of next year, too. Mm-hmm. That's going to be awesome. So, of course, in the meantime, if you still have ideas, I guess, for FreeBSD or NetBSD, go ahead and post them to their respective places. We have a link to the FreeBSD wiki here where they're updating it with Summer of Code ideas. So get that info out now so students can start looking at that and finding things that might be a good fit for them and finding mentors, etc. You know, get that all thought out now. That way you're not scrambling at the last second, because a well-thought-out one, you're going to have a much better shot of getting accepted.
Yeah, so there's a list of ideas if you're looking for something to work on. And it's, most of those include a list of people who you should talk to if you're interested. You know, like adding SCSI parameters pass-through to CTL so that you can do that. So that if you're doing the CAM target layer stuff, you can actually pass through to existing SCSI without having to do translation.
Sure.
Which would allow for exporting DVD or tapes as iSCSI targets.
Hmm.
I can definitely see some use to exporting tape drives via iSCSI.
That's interesting.
Yeah. If you're interested, they have the contact for a person to talk to, and it lists, you know, what level of skill you need. So if you know that, you know, requiring advanced C is more than what you're ready to do, then you can look for one of the other ones that doesn't require as much.
Okay.
And there's lots of projects on here, but if you have ideas, especially, you know, things that don't require advanced C, you should definitely throw them in here and, you know, volunteer to be a mentor. I know people that have done it in the past said that even being a mentor, they've learned a lot. You know, it provides a different perspective and so on.
True. Well, definitely check that out. We're looking forward to finding out what the final projects are going to end up being. Of course, we'll bring that to you live on the show down the road when that gets announced. And hopefully a lot of them are successful this year.
Yes.
Okay, so next up, Dragonfly. Looks like a high availability sync for IPFW, I guess, 3 in this case, is landed in Dragonfly. So this is similar to PFSync. This new protocol is going to allow firewall dynamic rules to, state to be synchronized between two firewalls that are working together, for example, in a high availability with a CARP.
So yeah, so this is Bill Yuan did this over the Chinese New Year, and he built this feature, and basically you set it up. You create your edges and your center machine, and they will, the center machine will basically broadcast its state tables out to the edges. And if the center machine goes down, CARP fails over all the traffic to the edge, and the edge just lets the traffic continue to work. Normally, if you don't have this, if you have a stateful firewall where you know, you're allowed a connection out, and normally you don't allow anything coming in, but if it's the reply to something that went out, you want to allow it back in. If you fail over to the other firewall, and the other firewall doesn't have this dynamic state rule saying, oh, you know, machine number 3 inside the LAN actually requested this, we should let it in, it starts blocking stuff. And, you know, if your router goes down and everybody's internet goes out, and they have to make all new connections, that's not really as clean as the failover where they wouldn't even notice anything changed. And so that adds this, although it doesn't yet do the NAT state, apparently, the libalias that FreeBSD and Dragonfly use for in-kernel NAT needs some modernization before it can support this.
Okay.
So hopefully we can see that happen. And also the sync stuff should be fairly straightforward to port back to FreeBSD, which would be good. It's basically the only real feature that IPFW is missing when compared to PF.
Nice. Well, that is pretty cool. We'll, of course, keep an eye on that. I'd like to see that ported back since I've always been an IPFW fan.
Yes, me too.
Okay, well, great. Well, of course, I will keep you up to date with it if and when that lands in current. Okay, we got a bunch of beastie bits to get to and some feedback and questions. But, of course, really quick before we do that, the last sponsor this week, which is going to be Tarsnap, where you can go to tarsnap.com/BSD now. And before we get finished with the first story in the next segment, you'll probably have an account created and be ready to go. So, of course, they make it super simple. If you already know how to use the tar command, you're 90% of the way there. It's not going to be a very steep learning curve at all. You can download a client straight from the site. He's got binaries for just about everything. Of course, if you're super paranoid, hey, you can build it yourself. Source code's available too. How many backup programs do that?
Exactly.
You can verify, audit, and confirm that it's doing exactly what it promises to do, no more, no less. And because we don't trust binaries, we can heck build it ourselves to make sure it's doing exactly that. So check out Tarsnap. There's hardly anybody out there who can even offer anywhere close to what that is.
Yep.
So, of course, and it's dirt cheap as well. Heck, $3, come on.
The sign up button now has rounded corners and a drop shadow.
Ooh, wow. Wow, we are really rock and roll
fancy now.
There might even be some HTML5 that shows up in the next 10 years. This is crazy. This is really cool. But definitely check it out. I mean, the beautiful thing is you don't have to go to the website. I mean, once you get it set up, you throw it in cron, it just keeps running and doing its thing. And every now and then you'll check to see how much you've spent or whatever.
I get my invoice and it keeps telling me that, you know, you'll have to pay Colin again in 10 years.
That's right. It's not going to take a lot of money to keep it rolling. Of course, it's going to dedupe all your data. So if you're just backing up the same stuff over and over and over again, which is what I do, it's going to be very small. So definitely get it set up today. You'll yank yourself down the road when you do have that data loss or, you know, flood or tornado or fire, or if you live in the Bay Area, you know, the big one finally hits. Come on, make sure everything's backed up offsite.
Yep. And I've also heard rumors of release candidate for Tarsnap 1.0.37. So if you want to check out the news version, you can do that. And unlike previous backup program, you know, any other backup program, you can diff the version you're using in the new version and see exactly what's changed.
Nice.
Right? You don't get that without source code.
That's right. So definitely check it out today, folks. No reason not to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Beastie Bits. So first up, a couple heads up. We'll go through these rapid fire. FreeBSD 10.3 Beta 3 is now available. We have a link to the announcement on the mailing list there.
Yep, you got your regular AMD 64 and i386, as well as, you know, IA64, PowerPC, PowerPC 64, Spark 64, but also ARMv6 images for BeagleBone, QBox Hummingboard, Gumsticks, Panda Board, Raspberry Pi B, and One Board.
Nice. Okay, definitely check that out. So also next up, we have a Libra SSL. Turns out not affected by yet another bug. In this case, the OpenSSL Drown attack.
Yes.
We have a link to the Undeadly site with some details about that.
Yes, all the support for SSL v2 was thrown out of Libra SSL a while ago, so this particular problem cannot occur.
Nice. Okay, so NetBSD machines at the Open Source Conference 2016 in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. Hey, man, we just missed that. But it looks like we'll have a link to the mailing list here. Do they have more pictures, I assume? Or they have a list?
They have a list of
things there.
Machines, which is...
Oh, they have... Yeah, they have pictures as well.
Oh, do they?
A couple different sites here. But, you know, usual suspects. We got Raspberry Pis, Banana Pis, Cubitech, QB boards, some Sharps.
I saw an Orange Pi.
Oh, okay. So we got some Plathome Open Blocks, Rockchip, Radza Rock, okay, and some VIA different things. But yeah, of course, NetBSD runs on them all, which is pretty stinking awesome. I think he comes to Asia BSDCon. You guys should bring some more of those things out.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to get pictures of those in person. That would be fun.
Yeah, they do all these booths at non-BSD conferences. At the BSD one, you know, there's...
Yeah, bring it to the BSD conference. We want to see them too.
NEC was there, but yeah, you know, lots of people would be interested in looking at all these little devices, I think.
Okay. So next up, we have OpenBSD. Looks like they hacked and slashed their way and got rid of the Linux emulation. Mm-hmm. So don't need that anymore on OpenBSD. Yeah, yes. And I wish we didn't need it on FreeBSD, too. I mean, well, it's easy to have, but...
On OpenBSD, it was more that theirs was still only i386, and it was based on a really old Fedora, and so they decided to just get rid of it.
Done with it.
Yeah.
That is true. Yeah, I look forward to the day when we don't need it either, but hey, you know, sometimes you do.
Yeah, well, you know, if the rest of the world would just make portable apps.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so it looks like George Neville Neal did a Time is an Illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a talk here? Is there a video associated?
No, this is just an article for the ACMQ magazine.
Okay.
But very nice. Basically talking about the, you know, keeping the time synced on your computer. And there's two different major aspects for that. There's the synchronization, which is your clock showing the same time as the other computer at the same time. But also syntonization, which is... your clock not getting off course after it's been synced.
Sure.
You know, and it's got some fancy graphics. If you look at this precision time protocol log graph of how far off the computer was over time, and you can see that, you know, inside your computer, there's actually a little quartz crystal that regulates everything, and it costs about 10 cents, and everything in your computer is based on it.
Right.
And sadly, because it's a physical crystal, it's affected by things like heat and... list of other things can really make quite a difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Lastly, here we have OpenSSH 7.2 has landed as well. Mm-hmm. We have a link to the notes for that. It looks like they say it's primarily a bug fix release, so a couple security things. Looks like some new features did land, though.
Yep. They have a deprecation warning here. In the next version of OpenSSH, RSA keys smaller than 1024 bits will not be allowed. Currently, the minimum is 768. But if you have anything less than 1024, you'll need to switch that. Otherwise, next upgrade, your keys will stop working.
Looks like they're going to be... this release does disable a number of legacy algorithms as well. So it looks like several ciphers, Blowfish CBC, Cast 128 CBC, all the ARC4 variants, and the Rindell CBC aliases for AES. So things did get nuked.
It's interesting to see Blowfish going away. I would have expected that one to still be there. But and they're also getting rid of the MD5-based and truncated HMAC algorithms, which is a good thing.
Good.
Apparently, these have already been disabled by default in SSHG for a while. They're just having the code completely removed now.
Oh, good.
Yep.
Good to see. Okay, so that's the Beastie Bits for the week. So let's get into feedback and questions. And we're going to be starting with Shane this week.
Mm-hmm.
He writes in about IPsec. He says, hey, guys, keep up the great show, even if it is only once a week. Well, we will be glad to do that. He says, a couple weeks ago, somebody asked about an IPsec tutorial as there hasn't been an update, and I thought I would share the little that I know. The handbook includes chapter 13.7 about VPN over IPsec. The bad news is it's not supported in the generic kernel, so you need to build your own. And he shows the example of how you can add that by doing a new IPsec config file and then just including generic. And then, of course, do your make build kernel, kernconf equals IPsec, install kernel equals kernconf IPsec. And then, of course, you can package install the IPsec tools. He said, I'm still in the idea phase. I haven't tried to get this working. And he says, while the handbook says both sites need a gateway running FreeBSD, I expect the range of consumer routers that support VPN pass-throughs should allow this to work from an internal machine.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So I think we mentioned this before the show. IPsec got turned on. I did check
that. It is by default on in 11. I don't know if that got backported to 10 or not.
I don't know. But it is coming.
Yes.
So at some point,
so, yes,
be on by default.
By this summer, every new release will have it. Maybe 10.3 will. I don't actually know. Basically, if it's in the release candidates or the betas now, then it will be. And if it's not, then it won't be.
Sure.
Because that's, hopefully 10.3 can recover from its kind of...
Yeah, if you're watching this some significant point in the future down the road, then by that point, hopefully it's just on. You don't even have to worry about those steps anymore, which is good.
The main reason it wasn't on by default is because it made things slower, but the after... George Neville Neal's project of measuring it and using DTrace to figure out why, they fixed most of it, and it's not really any slower now, and so why not use it?
Sure. It's just the convenience of not having to recompile the kernel. I mean,
exactly.
I'd like to get to the point where everything's just a kernel module, and there's almost no reason to ever recompile by hand.
pretty much do that now. Mm-hmm. IPsec was one of the only things that would
hold out. Well, Alt-Q was the other one for me.
Right.
Not having Alt-Q support for PF, but still, it's getting there. It's mm-hmm. getting there. Although vImage, when that goes on by default, that'll be another one as well.
With all those things will be set.
Yes, yes. Okay, you want to read the next one?
So Daryl writes in and says, hello, Alan and Chris. I sent in an email about a 14 terabyte server I built that was having a problems with read and write speeds. Turns out his HighPoint Rocket Raid 2320 was hiding smart data from one of the Western Digital green drives, which was failing. When he ran SmartCTL, it would not give him any usable data. I moved all the drives off the HighPoint card under the motherboard's SATA ports, and everything just worked. I found the bad hard drive and did a ZFS replace, or Zpool replace, and it took forever, about 1 megabyte per second, because the drive was dying. But once he removed the bad drive and the receiver finished at full speed, he was able to adjust his pool, and now everything is fast again.
Nice.
So that's another one of the downsides to using a RAID card is they often will try to hide the errors from the thing, because back in the day, if Windows saw an error from the disk, it would freak out.
Sure.
And so RAID cards started hiding those errors and trying to solve them internally. And, you know, to avoid scaring the user with errors about data corruption or whatever. The problem is ZFS actually wants to know about that.
Sure.
So that, you know, it says, oh, this one drive is having an error. If it gets too many of those, I'm going to automatically offline it and run off the redundancy so that the system doesn't just grind to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, you know, if you have direct SATA ports or use an HBA instead of a RAID card, you'll have much better results.
Well, cool. Hey, he says, I'm also working at replacing all my Windows computers with PCBSD and servers of FreeBSD. So that's awesome.
Good job.
Yeah, glad to hear that. Let us know how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so who we got last here? We have...
Pedja writes in about ZFS setup. Says, hi, I have a FreeBSD VM, which I plan to use as a salt minion at some point. For now, I have it as a sandbox to play with and learn FreeBSD. And there's a lot to learn. So his question is, he's currently tracking the dash stable branch, and building and updating the system is pretty straightforward, thanks to the handbook. But checking for broken missing libraries after the update is somewhat confusing. What is the proper slash blessed way to do this? He says, I ran libcheck as recommended by the handbook, and it spewed out a list of stuff, unreferenced libraries in lib, user lib, and user local lib. But package underscore libcheck or package dash check minus BA and package dash check under DNA haven't found anything. So I guess the handbook needs to be updated. It's package space check now. So those are part of the package command and no longer part of the old package underscore tools. And I don't know that the flags are the same. So you want to read the man page for package dash package check or run package help check from the command line, and it will give you the man page. He says the libcheck man page does warn it might have false positive though. So after you do the update, if you did the make delete old or whatever it's called, it should remove most of the unreferenced libraries in your slash lib and user lib. And that should help. Then he says, so using synth, which is an awesome tool, he says, I've updated the system and everything works fine as far as I can tell. He says, currently the system has a ZFS pool made of a single disk VDEV, and I'd like to migrate to RAID Z1 or RAID Z2. What are your options? In that case, you would have to build the new pool and then ZFS send to it.
Yeah.
If you wanted to switch to mirrors, you can use the zpool attach command to add a second disk to the existing one and turn it into a mirror. And then you can just keep using the pool you have. But, you know, mirroring doesn't give you the same space efficiency, so it's up to you.
Sure. Let's see. He talks about cloning, doing vadmin.
Yeah, so basically,
you answered that.
So what you'd want to do is take a recursive snapshot of the entire pool, so just ZFS snapshot minus R zroot, relocate or whatever, and then ZFS send that piped into ZFS receive on the new pool, and you're all good.
Cool. He also asked, is FreeBSD ZFS implementation based on the OpenZFS project?
Yes.
So, it is. So, yes, if ZFS on BSD and Linux should have reasonable feature parity interoperability.
That's
the idea.
The Linux one is sometimes slightly further behind, but in general, yes. So, basically, when you update versions of FreeBSD and when you run zpool status and it says, oh, you there's features you're not using, you run zpool upgrade. If you plan to use the pool with Linux, don't do that right away.
Yeah,
make sure that those features are supported by Linux or the version of Linux you're using, at least, before you update. And then as long as you don't get too far ahead, it's compatible. Each of the flags also will have a will indicate whether it's read-only compatible or not. Some of them, if you enable it, you'll still be able to read the data sets, but any data sets that use the new feature, you won't be able to write to on Linux. But it depends. You know, if, say, a new compression algorithm comes out, then any data sets using it, you won't be able to read on Linux until Linux gets support for that. But in general, yes, they're compatible, and you can move a pool between Alumos, FreeBSD, Linux, and the OpenZFS on OS X project. So you'd be able to use it across all the operating systems except Windows.
Okay. He said also, thanks for all the hard work you put into making BSD Now. He says TechSnap is also cool, by the way, Alan. It's fun to watch, and I actually learned something from it, which is pretty rare these days. Well, great. Well, we appreciate it. Okay. So, of course, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. So we want to remind you we're going to be gone a week. So keep the questions, comments, or if you have stories you find, be sure to send those in. We're going to be pretty darn busy when we're out at Asia BSD Con. So try and get those all sent in. And, of course, we'll sift through them all when we get back and prepare for the episode immediately following where we can share all those stories and, of course, our stories we have from being in Tokyo. And we'll look forward to talking to you about that live in a couple weeks. So, of course, send those to feedback at bsdnow.tv. That's the only place we monitor, so just keep sending them there. If you don't get a reply, don't worry. We're probably just super tired and busy from being out all night and doing fun BSD stuff, but we promise we will get to them. So, of course, thanks for watching this week, and we'll look forward to seeing you same time in a few weeks.
Yes. See you next week.